Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Well, another week, another Royal Scandal podcast.
Yeah, back to the royals. A different kind of royal angle, though, for us.
Yes, very interesting man that we're going to be talking about today, I think.
Yes, Lord Snowden, husband of Princess Margaret. For a while.
And we've got Andrew Corsi, who is the biographer of Snowden, and he's always very good value.
Yeah, a very classy writer and a very classy biography. One of those that is as much social history as biography, you know, the world that these people moved in. It's fascinating. And it's great. If you want upper class gossip, we are the place for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think Anne is so brilliant because her research is impeccable, but she writes, very engagingly. And so, you know, I hope this will lead people to some of her other books.
Yes, well,
but we've been asked about Snowden a lot, and he is an interesting man and often sort of passed by. And it's a new way of looking at Princess Margaret, too.
It certainly is. We've had a lot of interesting feedback. Do you want to hear some of it?
Yes.
Actually, it's been quite a good week. You know, we've a big milestone. We passed 300,000 downloads this week.
Gosh.
320, I think. Across all the platforms, which, you know, in a year and 2 months is pretty amazing. Thank you for everybody who has helped contribute to that. A lot of people have been in touch on the various platforms. This one starts well. Deborah Copeland, wow, this is nice. From older men with British accents.
that's one of our image.
Yes, maybe she meant you, Andrew. Maybe she meant you.
Yes, well, I bring a bit of class to it, I think.
Yes, well, the mailing show got people talking. Not everybody, I mean, a lot of people loved it, but Peter Plum took us to task. He's listened to all the episodes. Thank you for that, Peter. But he thought this was not our best work. We rushed it a bit, and we didn't get to important parts of the story, such as the struggle with the Vatican to give Rudolf a proper Catholic burial. Sorry about that.
She could always come back. I'd be interested to see what other people feel. I think it's a big story, and we could have gone in lots of different directions. And I thought we covered a lot of ground.
Well, we did. I mean, I think we could structure these things more if we wanted to be like proper journalists. But I think it's quite nice that we ramble a bit. It's loose. People can take the conversation in the direction they want to take it. And a lot of people like that. Leslie Fisher-Rice has been in touch. You're the best podcast ever. The perfect balance to your broadcasts. The best of any British or American podcasts I listen to. Isn't that nice?
Gosh, I think we should pin that as a tweet somewhere.
Yeah, we probably should. And somebody else likes our approach. The gentle, easy mix and the fact-based stuff makes for great listening, says Jane Buckland. So we are pleasing some other people some of the time.
Oh, good. And do keep sending in those suggestions. We've now got quite a number of programmes that we've actually done interviews for people that you were keen to hear more about.
Yeah, we're slightly spoiled for choice, actually. If lots of good things in the bank, we've got something in the blood bank, infected blood scandal, which is a great interview. That's going to come up in the next couple of weeks. Wonderful conversation about White Mischief, which we recorded recently with James Fox, the writer of the book of that name.
and the Canadian perception of sewers. So yes, it's a pretty varied program we've got.
All human life is here.
Yeah. And all human life, I think, is with the Lord Snowden story too.
Yes, well, it's got a bit of everything, hasn't it?
Illegitimacy, bisexuality, all my favourite subjects.
Posh people taking drugs. Posh yes. people sleeping with other posh people. Posh people sleeping with posh people they shouldn't be sleeping with. Oh, dear. Oh, well. It slightly defines your oeuvre, doesn't it, really?
It does, yes. But we try to please. We like to give people what they want.
High-class smut. Okay. Let's go to Anne. I bet she's got some great smut for us, and no doubt delivered in a very high-class way.
Yep. Well, that's our salute.
Okay, here we go.
Bye. Well, we're delighted to have Anne de Courcy this week, who's a very well-known historian, really, of the social history of the 20th century. And one of her best-known books is her biography of Lord Snowden. And I think really the first thing is to ask why you chose to write a book about him.
I thought he was an immensely interesting character. Nobody had properly written about him before. There'd been one or two biographies, but they were basically just press cuttings put together, you know. And I knew he'd led a very interesting life. And I thought if I could get him to talk and his friends to talk, one would learn an awful lot. He'd really, certainly in the 60s, he'd been very much at the cutting edge of everything. And he was also a brilliant photographer. He'd reached the top of the tree long before he'd met Princess Margaret. So that he wasn't helped by his royal connections at all. He got there by himself, which I thought was very good.
And how did you persuade him to talk to you? Because it turned out to be a very revealing book.
It took me a long time. It took me a year. And I remember that we had lunch. We somehow met over something. So we had lunch. And I put the idea to him because I said, you've led a very, how shall I put it, colourful life. And if I don't write about you, later on somebody who is probably a very down-market publisher focusing only on that will write about you, whereas I will give full weight to all the work you've done for charity, which he had. And in fact, I devoted two chapters to it. And he looked out of the window. My words trickled into sand. And I said, oh dear, well, perhaps we'd better talk about something else. And then we went out to lunch again. And I didn't even bring the subject up. But what I did notice, because I think you always have to use a bit of psychology when people are difficult, is that you know how in most restaurants, men always put the woman in the banquette seat so that she can see and be seen. Well, invariably, Tony took it. He liked to see and be seen. So I thought anybody who likes to see and be seen is also not averse to a bit of publicity. So I compiled a very careful letter. And then the next time we had lunch, I said to him, Tony, it's look out of the window time again. And a faint smile crossed his lips. And I said, I'm going to go back to the office and I'm going to write you a letter, what I feel. And can you let me know, please, one way or the other? And I got a very nice postcard saying, would you like to come round and look at all my files? And I took that as a yes. And so I went round once a week for 2 years.
And wasn't the undertaking that you wouldn't publish in his lifetime, but in the end, he didn't really care?
Well, I gave him a letter because I thought I'm bound to find out an awful lot. I gave him a letter that was looked at by a lawyer to prove that it was absolutely substantial, saying that I would not publish in his lifetime without his consent so that he would feel perfectly safe. And as time went on, he kept saying, when are you going to publish? And eventually, when I came to write the book, there really was an awful lot of pretty revelatory stuff. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought, I can't do a whitewash. That's not my style. I'd better write the book as though he's no longer with us. And if he doesn't want it published, I will put it on the back burner. And if he just wants a minor tweak or two, then I will do that. And rather nervously, my editor and I said to him, look, we've got the manuscript, we've got the book ready. And he said, neither Lucy nor I want to read it. Go ahead. And so we went ahead.
Gosh.
And did he had no idea what you'd written?
No.
After but all that rigmarole.
I gave him every opportunity because I absolutely believe in playing fair and square with people. I had no idea how much would come out, but he had very sweetly given me a letter to send to his friends saying that I was doing this book with his, it wasn't authorised, but please would they help me in any way. And so I met all sorts of people from his mistress, Melanie Cable Alexander, who he'd had this affair with and a child by. She came up to the restaurant table while we were having lunch one day. And I said to her in front of Tony, Melanie, I would love to talk to you. And she looked at Tony and said, well, I'll only do it if Tony agrees. And so I said, Tony, what do you think? I'd love to talk to her. And he said, oh, all right, go on. And so she came down with her little boy to stay in my cottage for the weekend. She was awfully sweet. I liked her very much. And we got on very well. And she poured it all out. She'd been given permission to. But, you know, that contained everything. And it was the same with various other people.
Because what else was revelatory about it? I mean, in this colourful life that he led.
What else was what?
What else was revealing?
Well, there was that. And then I remember there were always women circulating round Tony. I mean, all his life, he'd had numerous very pretty girlfriends, and this went on and on and on. And I remember once he told me that I ought to go and talk to Marjorie Wallace, you know, who ran the mental health charity, because he said she and he used to do features together. She was the writer. He was the photographer for the Sunday Times Colour magazine when it first came out. And I looked up those features, and they were wonderful. He did a marvellous one on an old people's home. I mean, they were full of dignity and feeling, absolutely marvellous. And I talked to Marjorie a lot. And you know, she told me about all these jaunts they had and how they pretended to be bringing the laundry in and got in secretly one day and were able to take some of these marvellous pictures, which was very good indeed. And after a bit, I said, I think I'm going to need a photograph of you, Marjorie, in the book, because you figure quite strongly. Well, most people, certainly most women, are a bit fussy about which photograph they give. So there was a little bit of va-et-vient about which photograph it was. And in the course of one telephone conversation, she said to me, you do know I'm his mistress, don't you? And it was one of the many occasions in my life, Andrew and Phil, that I haven't known how to respond quite.
And so this was news to you?
Yes. Well, it was news to everybody.
How interesting. And have you seen the portrayal in the Crown of him?
No.
You haven't?
Well, I looked at the first issue thing of the Crown, and I got very turned off when I saw that Princess Margaret towered over everybody else when you think how petite she was. Okay. I didn't really want to look at it.
Gosh.
Well, the man you're describing does sound quite like the one they portrayed, I have to be honest. Certainly in his charisma and sexual...
Yeah, well, you see, it does, because Robert Lacey rang me up and I didn't realise he was first that he was picking my brains. He went on and on and on about Tony, and of course I told him things. So I think he got quite a lot of that from me. That's where it came from.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, Snowden was open, but I mean, how did some of the other people around him feel that were being outed as mistresses and...
Well, Andrew, I don't think they were all very being outed. Women sort of revolved around him. I mean, I met him in his 70s and nobody could have called him an extinct volcano then. There was Lucy, there was a lovely girl I knew, someone else. I mean, they just orbited.
But did they want their private lives? You know, he was happy to talk, but I mean, were they happy?
No, they talked, not him. He was very cagey. He was very gentlemanly like that. All he would say was, oh, she was lovely. She's hardly...
How many of these affairs, if any, were happening whilst he was married to Princess Margaret?
Any of these first? Oh, yes, well, they were. I mean, Lucy, of course, was. I think the affairs started, but while he was married to Princess Margaret, they were, most of them were just sort of fleeting, I suppose you'd call them one-night stands, but there were a lot of those constantly. And there was one big one, I think, with a very beautiful model that went on for quite a long time. And there was a funny occasion. She was down at the cottage with Tony one day, and Princess Margaret's chauffeur, who was an awfully nice man who talked to me and who was very fond of the princess, he'd taken her to see friends in Brighton or somewhere, and she said, oh, let's call in on my husband on the way back, the cottage. And the chauffeur knew that this girl was there, and he didn't know what to do. He thought, oh, this is going to be awful, and Her Royal Highness, to whom he was devoted, is going to be shattered. And he said the only thing he could do coming up the drive, he switched his lights on and off, flash, 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 and hoped that Tony would realise that this was a signal. And when they got to the cottage, Tony greeted Princess Margaret warmly. And then he said to the chauffeur, look, the Jaguar, or whatever the name of the car was, it needs more petrol. Will you take it to the garage and fill it up, please, the nearest village? Well, the chauffeur knew perfectly well that the car was full of petrol because it was his job to see that they were every morning. But nevertheless, he said, yes, my lord, jumped into the driver's seat and drove off to this garage. And he said when he got there, he opened the boot and out jumped this pretty girl.
So Princess Margaret didn't know about these affairs, or she did know and she looked the other way?
I don't think she knew about it. She may have known Tony knew her, but she certainly didn't know that the girl went down to the cottage.
Because, I mean, there was also a child conceived literally as he was about to get married, wasn't there? Which was revealed much later.
Yes, yes. Whom I actually interviewed for the book. Yes, this was his great friend and his wife.
Fry.
Jeremy Fry, I think it was. And Jeremy Fry and his wife, Camilla. Camilla had been a girlfriend of Tony's before she married, and Tony used to go down there. They were a sort of golden couple, and there were weekend parties there. And as I said, everything was very cutting edge, and there was a lot of what I believe were called uppers consumed there. And so I think one of those weekends, one of those when they all literally got it together, this child was conceived. This was while he was courting Princess Margaret. She was born when they were on honeymoon. She was called Polly Fry. Very attractive, very like Tony, and she'd inherited Tony's wonderful taste. Her house was beautiful.
And when did she discover she was his child?
People kept saying things to her, she told me. I asked Tony if I could interview her, or asked her, and she said she'd got to find out from Tony, and he said yes. And so because he'd said yes, she talked to me, so down I went to see her. I think she... She looked quite like him. She had that slightly long upper lip that is very often a sign of being funny, and she was quite funny, and Tony was very funny. And his colouring, she's very interested in artistic things. So she was quite like him. And she was not like her siblings, you see. She looked different from them. They were all nice-looking, but she had a different look. And I think a lot of people who'd been around at that time knew roughly what was going on. A great friend of mine, who was also a great friend of Tony's, certainly knew. And so word gets out, rather in the way Lady Diana Cooper learnt that Harry Cust was her father, not the Duke of Rutland. It got borne in on her. And eventually she thought, I must decide this one way or another. She said to me, you know, when you get into your 40s, you really want to know what your roots are, which is very understandable. And so she wrote to Tony asking if he would take a DNA test. And that's how they discovered.
Gosh, so he had no idea either?
He might have had a little. But, I mean, I think that probably this wasn't an isolated occurrence. And so there might have been a number that he didn't inquire too closely in.
And Jeremy could have been his best man, couldn't he? But wasn't.
Yes, that's right. I think there was some kind of, was it homosexual scandals? Something like that, I think, and stopped him being.
And that was the palace stepping in because Jeremy was understood to be gay.
Yes, they didn't want press sort of saying, look, and pointing the finger. And I mean, things were much, quite different in those days. And this was, after all, I think, wasn't it before the Wolfenden Act? It was.
Yes, 1960.
Yes, they got married in 1960. I can't remember when the Wolfenden Act was.
67.
Yes, so I think, you know, you just didn't want people saying this is against the law. Or
how did the palace react to the book? I mean, and how did Snowden's family, I mean, his children, for example, discovering all this?
I don't know how his children reacted. Tony was furious with me. And I think the palace reacted quite well. I got a very nice letter from one of the ladies in waiting saying, "We," and she wouldn't have said this if her boss hadn't approved, "we are all very pleased with the portrayal of Princess Margaret," because I felt very sympathetic to Princess Margaret, who'd had a very tough time. You know, Tony sort of, as he put it, he liked change, he liked to move on. And I mean, her, the princess's template of marriage, was really how that of her sister and her parents, who had spent time together, stuck together, been together, and been a loving couple. And that's what she had very much hoped for. And
was it really his behaviour and the affairs that spoiled their marriage in the end, or was there a deeper problem, do you think?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I think there were two things. I certainly think the affairs had a lot to do with it because they were very shattering for the princess. And also, she was very good about him getting a job, and she helped him get the Sunday Times job, you see. She was very good like that. And it was, she didn't see that much of him. He'd be out at work all day, and then he would rush down to his workroom in the basement of Kensington Palace. He had this studio workroom. He was brilliant at making and designing things. I mean, he could have made a Boeing 737 out of a pair of bent safety pins. He could just do anything. And he would go down there night after night, and she'd hardly see him. And then if he went abroad on a trip, which he did quite often for the Sunday Times, if he rang up, he wouldn't take the calls. I mean, she felt very neglected. And you see, as I've just said, her idea of marriage was a couple who were together and everything. And suddenly finding that the husband she'd fallen in love with and married, she didn't hear from him for 3 weeks, was ghastly.
I mean, he was very rude to her. I mean, abusive, really. I mean, the book paints a very sympathetic portrait of her and what she put up with.
Yes. That's right. Well, she had to put up with it. He was very rude to her. He was awful to her.
And I mean, she'd leave rude notes for her to find and things, didn't he?
That's right, yes. You know, you look like a Jewish manicurist in her glove drawer. At first, it was all roses till about Sarah's birth. And they were devoted to each other. They adored each other. He was extraordinarily helpful to her. He helped her with her speeches. He was very supportive. And she had no reason, really, to think that this wasn't going on. And suddenly she found herself bereft. I mean, he sometimes left her at parties and she didn't know how to get home. She'd never run for a taxi in her life. And she felt, you know, just abandoned.
And was this behavior motivated by selfishness, by guilt, by a broken childhood?
I think this behavior was motivated. He was very quicksilver. He liked moving on. I once said to him, "What made you behave like that?" And he said thoughtfully, "I like change." And I think he thought he'd been devoted to her for 4 years. That was enough. We can live in an atmosphere of tolerance, but I must be given my freedom. I think it was a bit that. His childhood had been very upsy-downsy because his father had married a number of times. There was always seemed to be a different house and a different stepmother. And his mother had, after they'd divorced, his mother had married the Earl of Ross and had two little boys, and they were her priority. Tony and his sister Susan, to whom he was adored and to whom he was devoted and whom he adored and who he was close to all his life, they would go to stay at Castle Ross, at the house, and she would introduce her sons to people, and then she would say, "Oh, and this is my other son." And Tony and Susan were very much second-class citizens.
But how did you feel the end of the book? How did you view him? How had your views changed? And did you feel, clearly a very complex and paradoxical character?
He was very complex. He was very paradoxical. You're quite right. He could have great charm. I felt an awful lot of his problems stemmed from a childhood with a mother who didn't really take much notice. He was always trying to gain her attention, but not in obvious ways. And it was only when he married Princess Margaret that he got a sort of well done from her. Then she really paid attention to him. But it was too late. I mean, if he'd had the love and attention that I think that other people, so many of people's problems, I think, do derive from their childhoods. And he'd been rather tossed from pillar to post. And he was very funny, and he made full use of that. And he knew he could make people laugh. He knew he could attract them. And you use, as you're growing up, you tend to use what weapons you've got.
And did Margaret have affairs? There's suggestions, for example, she had an affair with Peter Sellers.
I don't think for a minute she had an affair with Peter Sellers. Tony was absolutely adamant that she never did. But he had fantasies about her the whole time and really got alongside Tony in order to try and get alongside her. She had one with Robin Douglas Hume, but I think hers were mostly what I can only describe as revenge affairs. So you're not taking any notice of me. Well, there are other men who find me attractive, that sort of thing.
Do you think that the Townsend affair had any sort of consequences for her, or had she got over that?
I feel very strongly that she'd got over it, because Townsend started, it could almost at the beginning have been called a teenage crush. She was only about 15. And, practically everybody falls in love for the first time and doesn't marry their first love. They probably always harbour tender feelings for them, but they don't.
Well, the Queen was a good example.
Well, the Queen did, but most people, I certainly didn't marry the first person I fell in love with. And quite possibly, Andrew, you didn't. But who knows?
So that's my secret.
Exactly.
It is an incredible world, picture you paint of these misbehaving aristocrats and generally posh and rich people. But somewhere between charming rogue and manipulative bastard, where would you put him?
Well, one day he was one day he was another. He was very manipulative. There was a wonderful story of him when he was sent to New York by Vogue, who, they're notoriously skinflint because they haven't got that much money. The editors get a lot of money, and he was put in a sort of cold water flat somewhere. He didn't even have a telephone, and he protested, and nobody took any notice. And one day the editor needed to ring him up, and he said, "Well, I can give you the number to ring me on." And he put her through to Father Christmas's grotto, and there was a sort of, "Ho, ho, ho, little girl, what can I do to you?" he was very good like that, and he did get a telephone then.
So did you find him charming at all? Could you see why so many women fell for him?
I could see why so many did, but I'm not tremendously good on short people. It was just, I liked him. We got on. I used to make him fish cakes sometimes. He loved nursery food, and he was always very thrilled. I got on. I was fond of him. Of course I was. And so I was upset when he was upset. Yes, he was nice to me, always.
And why did the royal family like him so much? Because, I mean, given the way he treated Margaret, you would have thought they wouldn't be very sympathetic.
Oh, that's easy to answer. He had great charm, and he had delightful manners. When he wanted to please, nobody could please better. He got on incredibly well with the Queen Mother. Both the Queen Mother and the Queen knew that Princess Margaret could be difficult and was difficult sometimes. And so when it all went wrong, and there was Tony, sweet, delightful, charming manners, everybody, they all said, oh, poor Tony. Their sympathies were all with him. We know she's difficult. Of course it must have been awful. So that was really why. I mean, he adored the Queen Mother. He told me he thought of her every single day of his life after she'd died. He admired and respected and loved the Queen, thought she was wonderful. So all that was totally genuine and would have stayed genuine.
And how did you feel about Princess Margaret after you read the book? I mean, and what did you discover quite a lot that was new about her?
Well, the conclusion I came to was that one of Princess Margaret's chief troubles was that she was basically very bored. It was sort of before the days that princesses got very involved in charities and this, that, and the other. She was involved with the ballet, which she loved, and her behaviour with them was excellent. She knew all the dancers' names. She took a real interest. But she didn't really have anything to do. She got up. Her breakfast was brought to her. Possibly she wrote a letter or two. What did she do then? She perhaps washed her collection of shells. But she had nothing much to do. That's why she looked forward to the evenings so much, when she could have the friends who did work would come round. And that's why she was such a night bird. I mean, she didn't have enough to do. She was very intelligent. I think she always rather resented the fact that the Queen was educated in constitutional history and she wasn't, because she was 4 years younger. I think that was a lot her problem, not having enough to do.
And a bit spoilt. I mean, you know, the stories of her racing through her food so that people had to finish their food before, couldn't, you know, if they hadn't finished, the plates were taken away.
I think she was a bit spoilt, but I think that was, again, partly boredom. And what should I do today? I know. I'll make them eat quickly. I'm sure it was a lot of that, because she used to very much like the company of clever people. I mean, she'd go and stay with Professor Plum, and her ladies-in-waiting told me that after the divorce, if she went with them to Rome to a museum, she was one who took notes, who would say, no, we've seen that picture last time we were here, we'll go and look at this. And she was very good showing her children pictures. She would take them to look at one particular picture and really talk to them about it, so they really got to know that particular picture rather than just going through looking at a lot. So she really needed her brain using and didn't get it.
And, I mean, did she get it with her relationship with Llewellyn? Because, I mean, there's a much younger man, not an obvious intellectual. So what was it there?
The funny thing was, he looked frightfully like Tony, and he was very like Tony in a lot of ways, but he was awfully kind to her. And I think after the last part of her marriage was incredibly bruising, you know, not speaking to each other, saying to the controller, perhaps Lord Napier, will you pass the salt? Will you ask the princess to pass the salt at the dining table? It must have been simply awful. And I think she just thought how wonderful to have somebody kind, nice and attractive. It was
For people who don't know, maybe listening or watching, Roddy Llewellyn was, well, what was it? He was her boyfriend, lover in the latter part of her life.
Yes.
And he came from a rather sort of rougher background, perhaps, to most royal boyfriends.
No, he wasn't. He came from quite a posh background.
Did he?
Yes. Oh, yes.
His father was a baronet.
Ah.
I mean, it's all relative, but...
Yes.
But yes. Also, I mean, he was much younger than her, too.
Yes, and you see, in those days, that was a scandal. That's what everybody always said, oh, he's so much younger than her. Whereas I don't think people would mind that now. You know, you have Joan Collins marrying a man 35 years younger, and everybody says, well done. And she's very happy. And it's not a scandal. But then it was considered a scandal.
And were there particular challenges in doing the book? I mean, because you taped him, he gave you access to all his records, he allowed you to speak to everyone. So was it easy to do, or were there problems?
It was fairly easy to do. The extraordinary thing was, though, that I had quite difficulty persuading Weidenfels to take it.
Gosh.
And I had Chatto sort of champing in the wings, saying, why don't you give it to us? Why don't you? We would like it. And eventually, they said, yes, Weidenfels said, yes, we will. And they took it, because I'd been with them for some time, and they do biographies very well. You know, they're very good. They have very good copy editors, very good. Everything is very good about it.
So, and was it one of your most successful books, do you think, in terms of attention and sales?
In terms of attention and the money it made me, certainly, because it got hugely serialised in the Daily Mail, and then it got serialised a second time when Tony died, and then there were extracts sold to places all over the world, Vanity Fair and Russian Vogue and goodness knows what. So from that point of view, yes, it was very successful.
I've heard some of the tapes, an extract from one of the tapes that you recorded, and it does sound like a lot of fun. I mean, often he's saying, come on, Anne, let's have another drink.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Mm. You make a wonderful radio program. And is there anything you would add now or change? Have new things come to light since his death, for example?
Not that I know of, because I haven't, not that I know of at all. William Tallon, the Queen Mother's, you know, backstairs Billy, the Queen Mother's page, was very good chatting to me. He was very funny and good. And I used to have lunch with Tony every Sunday.
I mean, one of the sad stories is the Mistress Anne Hills, who committed suicide.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that story? And because she doesn't look like an obvious sort of mistress for him.
No, but you see, Anne Hills was, I think she wrote a lot for The Guardian. I don't think she was a very happy person. I did talk to her father, was very good and talked to me for a bit. And I've forgotten, she met Tony at some charity do, I think. And Anne Hills had this way of, if she fancied someone, she would make overtures. And she turned up on Tony's doorstep one day and said, I'd like to have an affair with you.
Phil, you must try that.
And, you know, she was pretty and all that. And as Tony said, you know, you don't turn down that sort of chance in a hurry. And so they did have an affair. And this went on for ages. He would always keep in touch with these women. He didn't like to lose any of them. And then eventually, life went wrong for her. She got older. She got less. Her work was going very badly. She wasn't seeing Tony. I mean, there were about six really nasty factors in her life, of which not seeing Tony was one. I mean, he was not the cause for her suicide. I'm absolutely certain of that. But he was a factor among half a dozen.
What's a sad story?
His was the last voice on her answer phone. That's what focused it on him.
Gosh. And if you were to sum him up, his legacy, I mean, would it be as a campaigner for the disabled? Would it be as an inventor, as a photographer?
I think, Andrew, I think it would be all three, because he was a terrific campaigner for disabled people. I went to several of his meetings and they were all incredibly grateful. And he did things like, I think, at the investiture, Prince Charles. I mean, he noticed there wasn't a special access for disabled people. He would make a tremendous fuss about that kind of thing and get it done. He was very good like that. He did a lot of work for disabled people.
Because we forget that, of course, he was the person who arranged the present king's investiture in 69.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yes, and those lovely red coronation chairs, which were two in his house. They sold them up, which all the ones that were there. So he did a lot of work. He was brilliant at making things. when I went to his house the first time, I said, it looks as though you've got a wonderful bit of Regency wrought iron glass above your porch. And he laughed and said, well, actually, no, that's plastic piping that I heated and bent into shape and painted black and installed the glass in. It was not Regency. And another time I admired the antique mask with a fountain in the garden, a mask. It looked as though it was sort of stone mask. And, of course, it was actually a mask he'd bought down the King's Road, bought some concrete powder, glued it on, and fixed up the fountain. I mean, but it looked like something that you would have spent thousands on from Zion Court. So he could make anything, and did. And the doors of Kensington Palace, when he and Princess Margaret moved in, they didn't have much money. They were perfectly plain deal doors, and he cut mahogany panels and glued them on, and so that it looked like a wonderful heavy door when you arrived.
And were there things that you felt that weren't covered, that people weren't prepared to talk about, either elements of his life that remained a mystery?
Most people talk quite freely, I must say. I cannot think of anything. I mean, there may well have been questions that I should have asked but didn't ask that are still a mystery. I can't say about that, but I used to ask quite a lot of questions, and they were all very good talking to me.
Well, that's your experience as a journalist. I mean, years of just doing articles.
Yes.
And you recently talked about the importance also of how journalists have to write to deadlines, have to write very concisely, have to give colour. I think you talked about how people don't use colour enough in biographies.
No. Well, I think that's important.
There's no shortage of colour in your book on him, that's for sure. It's wildly entertaining.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for talking.
How was this conversation? So interesting and completely unique. Well, nobody else knows this stuff, really, and probably never will again. Because I think world is done now, isn't it? That world is
I know, yes. I know. It was extraordinary having a peep into that world.
Because we talked to Tom Sykes the other day, and he was talking about how his father would commandeer buses and use them, kidnap people, basically take the bus and go to use it to drive around
drive
London.
To his club, yes. happy days. Normal. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed listening to you.
Sorry I overlooked the first.
No, not at all.
Not at all. You are more technically adept than both of us put together. See you soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.